It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we look at a controversial new bill that would ban the use of aborted fetal tissue in medical research here in Wisconsin.
First, a group of Republican legislators is planning to meet tomorrow to talk about merging the Wisconsin Technical College System and the University of Wisconsin Colleges and Extension.
Lawmakers said this meeting is informal and preliminary. They said they'll be looking into whether merging these two college systems would let them operate more efficiently.
Karen Herzog joins us to talk about that news. She's a higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome back.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, Karen, as we said, some Republican legislators meeting tomorrow to talk about a Wisconsin education merger idea. Can you explain which entities might be merging under that plan?
Well, there's no plan. It needs to be made clear that these are described as preliminary and informal discussions. And there's no legislation that's been drafted. It's just something that has cropped up, you know, through the years that perhaps there could be some efficiencies achieved by looking at whether the UW system's two-year colleges would be merged with the technical colleges. So there are 13 two-year colleges in the UW system, and technical colleges, there are 16, and they're part of a separately funded and governed system, rather, called the Wisconsin Technical College System.
And you mentioned some possible efficiencies there. Could you tell us a little bit more about what those might be and what else might be driving a merger like this if it were to happen?
Well, there have been discussions through the years about whether there's unnecessary duplication of services. Because several UW college campuses and the technical college campuses are located within a few blocks or miles of each other. So they're both two-year institutions. Some would argue that they have very different missions, that the technical colleges are more aimed at preparing people for vocational jobs, rather, and that the UW colleges have more of a focus of preparing students for advancing their education at a four-year university. But the 13 colleges, 11 are located within 10 miles of a technical college, and three of them are actually adjacent to a technical college campus. So it makes sense to look at whether there are some efficiencies that could be achieved by, you know, looking at whether there are some duplications that don't need to exist.
Has this idea ever been floated before?
There hasn't been any formal public discussion of it, but it comes up from time to time that, you know, maybe we should look at these two systems because state funding for higher education isn't what it used to be. And I think there's always just those discussions of what can we do to do things better.
Now, we just had a budget pass which called for cuts to the UW system as a whole. Against that backdrop, does that lead you to believe that this idea will be taken any more seriously?
Well, I think the discussions are very serious about, there's momentum among state lawmakers and within the UW system administration to find efficiencies. I mean, that's kind of a necessity because state resources are limited. There isn't going to be more state money for higher education in the future, most likely, at least in the next 8 to 10 years. And so I do think that it's something that would be explored, but there are a lot of things to consider. You know, amongst those, the big questions would be, you know, does it make sense mission-wise to have them aligned? You know, and does it make sense to change their funding structures? Although the tech colleges used to be predominantly funded by property taxes, and last year there was legislation that was passed that provided property tax relief to taxpayers and shifted more of the burden to the state. So that's an interesting change that has happened with the tech colleges, that they are more closely aligned with state funding now, and also their performance standards that have been put into place that are tied to that state funding. And that's something that UW system has been talking about, is whether the legislature has discussed whether the UW system's funding should be tied to whether they meet certain performance standards.
We're talking with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Karen Herzog right now. She's talking about some news that Republican lawmakers are meeting tomorrow to discuss merging the Wisconsin Technical College System with the University of Wisconsin Colleges and Extension. Karen, what do we know about who's going to be at the discussion table tomorrow?
Well, Representative David Murphy, who's the chairman of the Colleges and Universities Committee for the Assembly, is going to be there. Representative Katsma is the point person. My understanding is it's five Republicans in the Assembly. And again, I've been told this is very informal, that they may not actually consider a merger. They're just looking into it and exploring whether it's something that would potentially make sense. So it's far from being a formal plan, but you just never know. I think anything's on the table these days with all the pressures that higher education, you know, faces in Wisconsin and elsewhere.
Now, you mentioned that this is a meeting of five Republicans from the Assembly. Is it typical in this case that it would not be a bipartisan meeting?
Well, I think that I think it was just a matter of a Republican came to Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, and said, "Hey, I'd like to look at this." And I don't know if there have been any attempts to reach across the aisle on this particular issue. But again, it's so early in that process that you know, I don't necessarily know that that would take place anyway.
Now, one concern when you have a budget that faces challenges at UW system and with technical colleges would be the possible closing of one of these places, maybe in a smaller community for UW colleges. Is that something that has been a concern and something that a possible merger could help prevent?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I know that there is, you know, no stomach for closing campuses because those are economic drivers in communities. The political will isn't there to close campuses. Plus, if you were to close a campus, the debt would still be there. Whatever debt that campus carries would have to be picked up by the rest of the system. So potentially this could help, you know, save campuses that otherwise, you know, would be hard to justify if they could find a way to really give each one, you know, its own mission and to, as you know, as you said, reduce some duplication.
Now, as you said, this is a very preliminary plan, very new, and the discussion is not happening till tomorrow. But have you heard responses from people who are for or against this possible plan so far?
Well, I think it's still really early. It's something that actually I think came as a bit of a surprise to some in the UW system, that they weren't aware that this was even going to be discussed. And it's lawmakers who are driving this. It's not the tech schools. It's not UW system that are seeking this. So there hasn't really been a statement from UW system or the technical college system as to whether, you know, they think it's a good idea or not. And I think that the politics these days are that you kind of sit back and see what happens, and, you know, when asked, provide, you know, your opinion and wait until you know more of the details about what's possibly going to happen.
All right, Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, so. You're welcome.
That was Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She was with us to talk about news that Republican lawmakers are meeting tomorrow to talk about merging Wisconsin Technical College System with the University of Wisconsin Colleges and Extension. State Republicans are moving forward with a bill that would ban the sale and use of aborted fetal tissue in Wisconsin. The State Assembly's Criminal Justice Committee held a public hearing today.
The author of the bill, Representative Andre Jacques, says the proposed law would establish a higher standard for medical ethics, but members of the medical community say it could prevent life-saving research from being done here in Wisconsin. Here with us now to talk about the bill is David Wahlberg. He's health and medicine reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. David, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Good to be here.
So there's already a federal ban on for-profit sale of fetal tissue. What would this state law do that isn't covered by that federal law?
Yeah, this bill would ban the use of fetal tissue in Wisconsin for experimentation or essentially research. And the bill defines fetal tissue as fetal body parts, and that includes a cell, tissue, organ, or other part of an unborn child who was aborted by an induced abortion.
And currently, there is this kind of research being done in Wisconsin. Where does the fetal tissue that they currently use come from?
Yeah, so there's actually sort of two things involved here. So there's fetal tissue, and then there's cells derived from fetal tissue. So taking fetal tissue itself first, There's about 6 to 8 labs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison that use that in various research. And they get that tissue from, I think it's 4 different approved banks around the country.
And then the second point you mentioned was cell lines that come from a fetal tissue from the past, not new tissue. And that sounds like it's been a gray area that's been a point of contention among sponsors of the bill, or between sponsors of the bill and researchers here in the state.
Right, yeah. I would say both types of tissue or both things are controversial, but the cells are sort of the bigger debate. So, yes, there are cells, cell lines that were derived about 40 years ago. The best-known one is called HEK293. I think that's the right number. And that stands for human embryonic kidney cells. And that was derived from a legally aborted fetus back in the 70s. And the cells have been grown up, and they're used and widely used in research labs around the country, both at universities and at biotech companies, like in use of vaccines, for example.
Now, what is Representative Jacques and his colleagues' argument against using a fetal tissue now, getting back to that in particular, for this kind of research?
Yeah, well, like you said in your opening, basically he says that he wants a higher standard. And I think he's mostly... at least he says he's mostly opposed to, you know, the newly used aborted fetal tissue in research, not so much the cells from years ago. And so he argues that that kind of tissue should not be used in experimentation. And, of course, the recent Planned Parenthood videos have given him maybe a lot more public interest in this issue right now.
And on the political side of things, is that giving momentum? Similar bans have been tried in the past. Is there a thought that in the backdrop of those videos, there's a better chance that this law would pass?
Yeah, that's what he said when he spoke to me last week. He did introduce a very similar bill in 2011 and then also in 2013. And, you know, given the Planned Parenthood videos and perhaps the changed makeup of the legislature, he thinks this bill has a better chance this time around.
As I understand it, the bill has been changed, addressing the issue that we were talking about a moment ago, those already existing cell lines back from the 70s. What has changed in the law to meet some of the objections that researchers have raised?
Well, yeah, and that sort of depends upon who you talk to. Representative Jacques says he's changed the law to allow use of existing cell lines like this HEK293. So he says, you know, as long as it happened in the past, that could still be used. But UW-Madison says the bill is vague enough that it still could affect those cells. And so they remain opposed to it for that reason, and also because they have some labs that use the fetal tissue, the aborted fetal tissue, which is definitely affected by the bill.
Talking to David Wahlberg from the Wisconsin State Journal about a proposed ban on the use of fetal tissue in research here in Wisconsin. Now, David, let's get into what kind of research we're talking about here. With the fetal tissue that everybody agrees the use of it would be banned if this law were passed, what kind of research is done with that?
Yeah, I didn't talk to anybody for my recent story about that, but a couple of years ago when the bill was introduced then, I did talk to a researcher on campus, and at least at the time, he was using pancreas tissue from aborted fetuses in research to develop new treatments for type 1 diabetes.
And then the other, the gray area there, as the law currently stands, the cell lines derived from the 1970s, what you mentioned, diabetes research, I think. What other kinds of things are being researched there?
Yeah, diabetes for sure for the fetal tissue. And then in terms of the cells, you know, pretty much anything you can think of, cancer research, Parkinson's disease, ALS, Alzheimer's, heart disease, cardiac arrhythmias. So there's definitely a wide range of applications for those cells in research. And the university says that if you total up the funding for the labs that do that kind of research, it's about $76 million a year.
And outside of the university, I believe you wrote that there are private companies doing this kind of research as well.
Yeah, there are. The biotech, BioForward, which is the biotech organization in Wisconsin, is also opposed to the bill. And I talked to the head of FluGen, which is a company here in Madison. It was started by a researcher at UW-Madison, Yoshi Kawaoka. And basically, they are trying to develop new vaccines for influenza that would cover more strains than the current vaccines. And they used those HEK cells in developing the vaccine. And the head of that company basically said, if this bill passes, we'd have to seriously consider leaving the state.
And university researchers have made the similar case that some labs, some faculty there, to continue their research, would have to leave Wisconsin. Is that a common argument there in response to this?
Yeah, they're saying that too, and that, you know, people could be recruited away from here, and people might not want to come be professors here. Now, André Jacques, the bill sponsor, you know, he says, you know, no, that he would allow the existing cell lines to be used, and that, you know, most of those people could still go about doing what they've been doing.
And then one other kind of research that we might lump in here, stem cell research, is that affected or would that be affected as people understand it by this new law?
No. Stem cell research is different, and you have two different types of cells there, too. You have embryonic stem cells that did come from embryos, but they're from discarded embryos at fertility clinics, not abortions. And this bill is specifically about abortion, aborted fetal tissue. And then the other kind of stem cells, the newer kind of stem cells, they're called induced pluripotent stem cells, or IPS cells. And those don't involve embryos at all. They just reprogram adult cells back into an embryonic state. So those two types of cells, which, of course, UW-Madison is quite well known for, are not affected by this bill.
One argument from sponsors of the bill is that research could still be done with fetuses from miscarriages, as I understand it. So what have researchers responded to as far as that goes?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about that, but basically the university folks are saying that tissue from miscarriages is not only not very available, but often the reason for the miscarriage itself, the medical reason, would make that kind of tissue unusable for these kinds of studies.
Now, this bill focuses on fetal tissue from abortions, as we've been talking about. Of course, it happens, it comes up against a backdrop of the ongoing debate over abortion itself in the country. Have you seen responses from pro-life and pro-choice groups to this legislation so far?
I'm sure they have responded. I've sort of been busy on some other stuff as well, so I'm not familiar with what exactly they're saying. But I do know that Planned Parenthood says that they don't offer tissue donation services in Wisconsin. And so their argument is that this bill is sort of, you know, moot in the state because they don't do that. Representative Jacques says, you know, that may or may not be true, but he wants to ensure that they don't do that. So this would prevent them from doing that in the future if they ever wanted to, he says.
As we mentioned at the outset, a committee hearing on this bill in the Assembly today. Do sponsors have a timeline for when they're hoping to bring this to the full legislature and get votes on it?
Yeah, as I understand it, Speaker Robin Voss is saying that a vote in the Assembly would likely come up in September or October. And I think the timing is a little less clear in the Senate at this point.
All right. Thank you so much, David, for joining us today.
Sure. It was good to be here.
We've been talking to David Wahlberg. He's a health and medicine reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. We've been talking about a Wisconsin bill in the assembly with a committee hearing today. It would ban the use of aborted fetal tissue for research here in the state. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Last month, the White House hosted the first ever tribal youth gathering at the White House.
The gathering was in collaboration with the Departments of Justice and Health and Human Services, along with the organization United National Indian Tribal Youth. Almost 900 Native youth representing 230 tribes came to discuss key issues to Native communities like education, tribal justice, and economic opportunity.
The gathering built on President Obama's launch of Generation Indigenous, an initiative aimed at improving the lives of Native youth in the United States. Well, joining us now to talk about that effort is Aaron Bailey, the Executive Director of the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're also joined now by Jasmine Espinoza. She's a 2015 Champion for Change at the Center for Native American Youth. She's from Wisconsin, and she's part of the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican Indians. Jasmine, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, Aaron, we're going to start with you. You're the Executive Director of the Center for Native American Youth. How does your organization fit into this Generation Indigenous initiative?
Well, the Center for Native American Youth is a lead partner with the White House and the Department of Interior on a piece of Generation Indigenous called the National Native Youth Network. And the goal of the network is really threefold: to elevate youth voices, to expand opportunities available to Native youth, and to provide opportunities to connect Native youth with each other. And we've heard lots of incredible stories from Native young people that are looking to connect with each other to catalyze their impact. But there are many other partners that are part of GenI. It really is an umbrella term, a comprehensive initiative that includes public and private sector partners working together to improve the lives of Native kids.
Native American young people have been called the most vulnerable population in America. Aaron, do you agree with that? And if so, why is it?
I mean, yeah, across every demographic, Native students are about 50% of them will graduate from high school. They have the highest rate of suicide, highest rates of homelessness, lack of health care access. But GenI is, and Generation Indigenous is really about elevating positive stories and providing opportunities and resources to young people. It isn't about focusing on disparities, but how do we work? We know that there are so many young people leading positive change across the country. How do we work with them, partner with them, and help them lead the change that they're already starting across the country and have been leading for many decades?
And Jasmine, we'll go to you next. What do you see as the goal and your part in taking part in Generation Indigenous?
My goal for what I do with Generation Indigenous is I run different programs in my community. And my goal is really to empower Native youth as well as educate them and make them aware of the obstacles that they and their peers face and help them learn how to keep themselves from being victimized and how to overcome the obstacles.
Well, what kind of obstacles are we talking about for someone who doesn't know? What do you see?
On my reservation, there is a lot of depression and mental illness as well as suicide and drug and alcohol abuse. And on top of that, there's domestic violence and poverty and things like that. And all the obstacles sort of play off of each other. So the domestic violence rate plays into the alcohol rate. The alcohol rate plays into the drug rate. So it all sort of bounces off each other.
Is any of this specific, as you see it, Jasmine, to Wisconsin? Or is this, do you think, the kind of issue that you see across the board with young people who are Native American?
I think it's really different to each community, not sort of state-wise, but community-wise. Each community has their own one that's more prevalent than the others. So I would say that all of the obstacles are across the board, across the United States. But when it comes to prevalence, it's based off community.
In particular in Wisconsin, are there any community problems that you see as specific to this state?
I would say we have... the alcohol abuse rate really is something that's a problem on my reservation.
And how do you see that playing out in your generation of young people who are growing up and going out into the world? How does it affect them?
Well, when their parents drink, it affects them, and it sort of puts it into their mind to be able to drink too. So kids are drinking younger and younger, and people are dropping out of high school, and people are partying and things like that, and it takes a toll on their mental health and their physical health, as well as their emotional state.
And Aaron, back to you. You were talking about wanting to build on the positivity. Young people, young Native Americans who are working for change and who are affecting that change already, what kinds of things do you see people doing that you'd like to capitalize on?
Well, as a part of the Gen I initiative, there have been 1,505 Native youth that have signed up to take President Obama's Gen I Challenge, which was a call to action to young people across the country to say, I'm going to create positive impact on my community. And so over 1,500 kids have signed up to say, and Jasmine is one of them and an incredible leader, to say we're going to, you know, do positive work to change the lives and the future for our peers. And, you know, just in Wisconsin, there have been 56 youth that have signed up to take the challenge. They range from kids that are becoming high school tutors, that are leading Toys for Tots events, anti-crime and drug prevention activities, and other health promotion campaigns. And I would just, you know, touch on some of the needs that Jasmine talked about. I mean, there's a deep historical context, generational trauma, and, you know, the disparities and the challenges that communities are facing are really connect back to tremendous historical trauma that tribal leaders and governments and young people are grappling with.
And Aaron, how do you do that when you've got a history that goes back so far? It goes back generations, not just the kids you're dealing with now, but it's a historical picture of the United States. How do you begin to address that?
Well, I think, I mean, for the purposes of the conversation today and talking about Gen I, I mean, I think that's what the president and the administration and private partners are attempting to do with this initiative, to come together and say, how do we work together to address these challenges holistically? I think from our role and me serving as the executive director of the Center for New American Youth, our role is really to say, listen, this is happening on community levels. We see it happening since the beginning of this year. We've directly connected with 2,100 youth across the country in their communities, and we've seen them leading change and having positive impacts all across the board, and this is about working with them. Very often, you know, well, we would say that we always believe that it's the young people and the communities and the governments and tribal leaders on the ground that know best for their communities, but they're too often hamstrung in terms of resources. For decades, the federal programs have been funded at half of need, and over time, that, you know, chronic underfunding and lack of capacity has led to tremendous capacity needs on the ground in communities. And so it isn't about coming in and saying we have a solution to the problem, but working directly with communities, building really strong partnerships, recognizing that there are well over 500 federally recognized tribes in this country that all have distinct languages, cultures, histories, and we need to be respectful of them and work together with them in developing those solutions. It isn't about a top-down, but really from our perspective, this is bottom-up. And I would say, you know, the administration has been announced a whole series of you know, policy changes and attempts and increases in funding and various programs that are really targeted at trying to remove barriers to opportunity for Native youth.
We're talking right now with Aaron Bailey, Executive Director of the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute. And also joining us is Jasmine Espinoza, 2015 Champion for Change at the Center for Native American Youth. And Jasmine, one program that you've been involved in that you created is called the I Choose Campaign. What is it?
The I Choose Campaign, it was actually my response to the Generation Indigenous Challenge. I signed up for the Generation Indigenous Challenge, and I was trying to decide on what I wanted to do, and I decided that I would create a social media campaign because I seen that there were so many, like I said previously, there are so many obstacles that Native youth face. And sometimes you have no control over whether you are subject to face them when it comes to being born into an alcoholic home or being born into a family that is divorced or something like that. There are so many obstacles that Native youth don't get to choose, and there are so many aspects in life that people in general do not get to choose. And the I Choose campaign is all about empowering Native youth to take charge of the choices that they do have the power over and to empower them to make healthy choices, to be able to better themselves and their lives and the lives of others.
And how have you seen that working with the I Choose campaign? What are people choosing?
There has been a wide array of things. I went around the community and I had a little poster that said I Choose blank, and I had kids all around the community fill out something that they choose that's healthy on a daily basis, that is in place of something that is not necessarily healthy. So people have wrote tons of different things. It could be anything from fashion to friends to love to anything that they're passionate about that they can use as a coping skill, that they can use to be able to better themselves or other people.
Now, this isn't the first initiative that you've created like this on your own. You also created the Warrior Circle Project, this based on your own personal history. Can you tell us a little bit about where that one came from?
I am actually a sexual assault survivor as well as a 12-time suicide attempt survivor. And throughout my experiences, I realized that a lot of Native youth don't have a place that they feel like that is safe to be able to go and talk about things and learn about things. So I created the Warrior Circle Project, which is based off of helping kids find their identity, not only through their culture, but through aspects of their own lives, and to be able to teach them and educate them and make them aware of some of the obstacles that they're going to face.
What kind of things happen in the Warrior Circle? We see how it helped you and what you went through and emerged on the other side of. Are you seeing that same thing with other people?
Yeah, it's been really great to be able to see that once you give Native youth the power to speak up and say, this is what I'm going through, this is what I want to learn about, how do I fix this, they really take it and run with it. It's been amazing to be able to see how many ideas and how many people's consciousness has come alive because you just made the conversation available. Not a lot of people want to talk about things like alcohol abuse or domestic violence and things like that, but when you make the conversation readily available, they're so ready to come up and talk about it and learn about it and move forward.
We're talking about Generation Indigenous right now with Erin Bailey, head of the Center for Native American Youth, and Jasmine Espinoza, champion for change at the center. Gen I is a White House initiative aimed at improving the lives of Native youth.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a part of the story? Did you grow up in a Native American community or work in a community of Native Americans? What challenges did you see there for youth? What opportunities? What success stories? And what questions do you have about Generation Indigenous? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post and find more info on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation now about Generation Indigenous with Jasmine Espinoza, Wisconsinite from the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohican Indians. And we're also talking with Erin Bailey, who is the executive director of the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute.
We're talking about challenges facing Native American youth in Wisconsin and around the country and opportunities to deal with those challenges. You can join in with your experiences, your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jasmine, I want to talk a little bit about one of the issues that Generation Indigenous wants to look at more closely, issues of bullying and negative imagery for Native Americans in school. How do you see that issue manifesting itself today in schools for young people?
I think that those two are very sensitive subjects as well as very important. There are a lot of times misunderstood by not only the general population, but by Native Americans themselves. And I think they really do have long-term effects on Native youth as a whole, whether it be emotional or has effects on their academics and things like that. Having to see those things every day or hear those things every day, whether it's negative imagery or cultural appropriation towards Native Americans or bullying, it takes a long-term toll on kids.
You said you thought that some Native Americans themselves were misunderstanding what was going on. What do you mean by that?
I think that, like I said, I believe that the first step towards overcoming an obstacle is having the proper information about it and the proper awareness as well as education on it. And I think that because these things are still sort of Native youth and Natives in general are still new to the scene of like advocating for these things and discussing these things, I think that a lot of people and Native people don't understand it properly because nobody's really stood up to try to discuss it in a proper manner.
We're going to go to our callers now. We've got Damian Thundercloud on the line from the Wisconsin Dells. Damian, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Thank you, Aaron and Jasmine, for coming on to the show today. I guess my question is to Aaron. I currently run one of the youth centers for the Ho-Chunk Nation, and I was kind of wondering how could I get my kids involved in the programming that you're involved with and get them to see what they can accomplish.
Damian, thanks a lot. Aaron.
Well, great question. You just teed me up. You can go to our website at www.cnay.org, and you'll see on there a Gen I tab. We've actually connected with your tribal leadership before, but we would love to get your kids more plugged in, the young people and leaders in your program. So please reach out to us, and all the contact information is on the website. We would love to engage with you.
And Damian, as someone who's working in these same areas right here in Wisconsin, is this resonating? Are you hearing some of these issues and going through some of the same things?
Oh, absolutely. What they're talking about is what I see every day, with the struggles that our kids go through with their home life and then even with the school system as well, being involved with the schools and what's being taught in the schools about themselves, basically, and having the identity issues that they have and dealing with the suicide rates and all that kind of stuff and the depression. I see it every single day with our kids, and I try to, obviously we have programming and preventions and all those kind of things that we provide for our kids, but also trying to get them involved in a bigger picture with a whole. That's not their own community, but as the state of Wisconsin. There are, 12 other tribes in the state of Wisconsin.
Damian, great. Thank you so much for calling, and thank you for your perspective there. And Jasmine, sounds like he's looking for that bigger circle of conversation like you were talking about. And I want to ask you, Jasmine, about the issue of suicide on the reservation. Now, this year, the Pine Ridge Reservation of Lakota, it made the New York Times this year because there was what was almost an epidemic of suicide among Native American youth there. And it is a big question, but why are Native American kids and teenagers vulnerable to suicide and depression?
I think a lot of stuff plays into that. Like Aaron touched on, there's the generational hurt that's been passed on and passed on from the generations, as well as I said earlier about the different obstacles playing off of each other. So I think the suicide rate deeply ties into the rate of alcohol abuse on reservations, the rate of domestic violence on reservations, as well as the rate of bullying and cultural appropriation. I think that it's just been drilled into Native youth's heads for generations and generations, all these false things about them and all these things that, in general, things that they have to go through on a daily basis, whether it be, like I said, alcoholism or low graduation rates or anything like that. I think that plays into the situation very much.
And Aaron, do you want to jump in on this? So what is being done with Generation Indigenous to address the suicide issue and get at mental health issues and keeping kids in class and all of that gets bundled in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been, I would say on the federal side, there are the Indian Health Service and many of the educational agencies have been working specifically on this issue. At the Center for Native American Youth, we worked with a young person on the Pine Ridge Reservation actually this year. Her name is Janae, and she created a completely youth-led, amazing weekend of positive outlets and activities for young people in the community. She attends the school where the spike in suicides has occurred, and so there are a lot of things happening on a public and private level. I would say that it's often not enough. It's the case that on many of these reservations, including that one, that maybe the larger than the size of the state of Connecticut, there may only be one or two healthcare providers. And so, just in terms of the healthcare system and capacity, like I said before, these programs are so underfunded that it's very difficult. If you look at, suicide is a symptom of much bigger problems, not just one. You can't point to one specific cause. But if you look at risk factors and you look at protective factors, it's very often that these communities have, like Jasmine talked about, are high in terms of risk factors and unfortunately sort of low in terms of protective factors. But as she's talked about, the strength of culture and the strength of commitment to community and mentors and all these those types of programs can make a really big impact in helping young people develop their resiliency to prevent suicide in communities.
And we leave it there. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Erin, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Jasmine, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for listening.
That was Erin Bailey, Executive Director of the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute. We also spoke to Jasmine Espinoza, a 2015 Champion for Change at the Center for Native American Youth. They were talking about their work with Generation Indigenous.
On the internet, no one can hear you laughing, and a once common way to express online laughter may be on the decline.
That's right. According to data released by Facebook, the abbreviation LOL, as in laughing out loud, has seen a massive decline in usage. It's been replaced by ha-ha, or in some cases, ha-ha-ha, or even hee-hee.
Well delivered. And this isn't a close thing. Facebook found that ha-ha was used just over half the time, like 50%. People use an expression of laughter. LOL, just shy of 2%. And those emojis, those little icons, are also cutting into LOL's closely held turf.
Well, this is bad news for me because I just started using LOL just in time for everybody else to stop using it.
And in person, you've had this new thing with me anyway, where instead of laughing at one of my really hilarious jokes, you just say, "That's very funny, Rob."
That's very funny, Rob.
And I think it's actually more of a social experiment than a sign of the times. How's that going?
I'd consider it, if I were you, feedback on the jokes themselves. Mm. They don't warrant a laugh, but
they
maybe
are very
just a
funny.
Statement.
They are very funny. You could just say, and I'll let you keep doing this, even though it's out of style, you can just say, LOL, Rob.
All right, or okay. LOLZ.
Oh, yeah, could plural of... I guess
laughs. Something like that.
Okay, well, thank you for LOLing along with us. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.